We've all done it. Stock our fridge with good intentions, only to sacrifice nutrition for convenience. Keep your body and mind nourished with whole body meal shakes from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But it actually tastes delicious. Try one of Kachava's indulgent flavors today. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags. Go to kachava.com and use code FITNESS. That's KACHAVA.com, code FITNESS.
Dr. Brian Kempel, welcome to Think for Christ.
Thank you, Anthony. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, since this is your first time on the channel, could you take a moment just to introduce yourself to the Think for Christ community? Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, so I'm a graduate PhD in philosophy from the Center for Optimistic Studies at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. I'm the executive director of the Lyceum Institute, which is a project that I'm still struggling to succinctly explain to anyone. But in short, our mission is to use the wonderful new opportunities that we have through technology to bring higher education outside the university and to really make those pursuits of education that are integral to human flourishing available to everyone. So we're working on that. I'm a lifelong Catholic, lifelong, almost as it were at this point, it feels like student of Thomas Aquinas. And I love philosophy and I love talking about it. So it's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. Before we move on, Brian, let me just take a minute myself here to plug the Lyceum Institute. I've been a member of the Lyceum since the fall of 2024, and I found it to be immensely valuable. I joined the Lyceum for kind of like ongoing postdoctorate education. And to date, I think I've completed 10, 11, 12 of your archived seminars. And let me just say, the quality of these seminars is just top shelf, really impressive. And for those interested, the Lyceum is not just a digital educational platform. It's also kind of a digital space that fosters a community of genuine, thoughtful truth seekers. So if you're listening right now, you're looking to get a first-rate education in classical philosophy at a ridiculously low cost, then I just want to encourage you to check out the Lyceum Institute. It's lyceum.institute, correct, Brian?
Yeah, that's the website.
All right, and I will go ahead and put the link to that website in the description of this video. Brian, in addition to being the executive director of the Lyceum Institute, you're also the executive editor of an excellent philosophical journal called Reality. And you can find this free journal at realityjournal.org. And I'll also include a link to the journal in the notes of this episode as well. And I would highly admonish everyone to go check that out. So Brian, in May, you published an essay in that journal that you titled Deeper Cosmic Significance, a reflection on what it means to be human in a vast universe. So I'd like to talk to you about some of the ideas in that article. In the essay, you say that there's an intellectual vision of the universe, a kind of habitual way of seeing the whole of reality that functions as a kind of presumptive background image of modern society. And you call this view cosmological nihilism. So let's start here. What is cosmological nihilism? What do you think motivates this view? And how has it come to be the background presupposition or the background image of Western society?
Yeah, I mean, they're great questions. And actually, I'm going to throw in one last pitch here for the Lyceum. This is developed out of a seminar which is taught at the Lyceum on Aquinas's cosmological vision. So I want to start just by distinguishing those two terms first to talk about image and vision, because one of the notions that I actually derived this in some sense from my own dissertation director, John Dealey, he talked about the background cosmological image that we all have, that whether we're fully conscious of it or not, we have a picture of the universe in our minds. We have a picture of where we are in the grand scheme of things, and it's not always actively operative in our thinking. Most of us aren't, you know, speculating on the cosmos on the day to day, but we have this sense of it. We have this sense of living in a whole in some way, not an HOLE, but a WHOLE. And this whole, this image that we conceive, that we hold on to, that we possess, is very influential on how we live our lives, whether we're conscious of it or not. So when I distinguish between the image and the vision is the habit, the faculties, the operations that we perform ourselves through which that image is crafted. And so today, most of us have a pretty strongly, I think, atrophied vision. Our capacities to perceive accurately, to form accurately an image of the universe, have suffered greatly by all sorts of different factors, all sorts of different influences that have come to prevail in our daily lives. And this has resulted in this confabulation, I guess, because it's wrought from many different sources, of this nihilistic cosmological image. This image that sees the universe as just this vast, enormous, meaningless expanse that is cold and harsh, and that is going sooner or later to destroy humanity and destroy our lives and bring everything to, you know, cataclysmic ruin in some way. And against that background image, if that's the way that we perceive things, if that's the way that we hold the universe to be, it's pretty hard, I think, to accept that our lives are meaningful in a fundamental mind-independent way, that our lives have meaning not just from our own actions, but precisely as constituted by the very fact that we exist. It's very hard to hold on to that truth when you have this background cosmological nihilistic image. And maybe another distinction there that's helpful just to draw out for people is what we really mean by nihilism. Because I think this is a term that obviously gets used in association with, say, certain German philosophers, perhaps some French philosophers as well. But I think there's, just to give a sort of quick distinction, there's what I'm talking about here, which is this cosmological nihilism, which is not an explicitly held notion necessarily, which is not something that people feel deeply on a personal level in the sense of, you know, I really think every day that my life is meaningless, which would be if someone does hold that, more of a personal nihilism, more of a real sort of despair, a real rejection of the thought that there's meaning in my life, that there could be meaning in my life. I don't think most people believe that. Certainly most people don't behave that way. In fact, the vast majority of people don't behave that way. Even people who call themselves nihilists don't behave that way. It's really hard to behave that way. But nevertheless, all of us, even those of us who are believers,
we've all done it. Stock our fridge with good intentions, only to sacrifice nutrition for convenience. Keep your body and mind nourished with whole body meal shakes from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But it actually tastes delicious. Try one of Kachava's indulgent flavors today. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags. Go to kachava.com and use code FITNESS. That's KACHAVA.com, code FITNESS.
First, struggle with this cosmological nihilism because it is so prevalent, because it is the prevailing presupposition that most people hold today.
Yeah. And, you know, today we live in a technologized society, and the ideas of our culture are being transmitted to us almost entirely through the vehicle of digital media. We're increasingly encountering culture in a digital environment. So how would you evaluate the effect that this is having on the background assumptions of society? Is the ascendancy of the digital age challenging, or is it reinforcing the dominance of cosmological nihilism in our culture? Is a life that's, let's say, saturated in a digital environment, is such a life more prone to the habit of this nihilistic intellectual vision? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of a both and. I mean, I think for the most part, and most obviously, it appears that the digital environment has rendered negative consequences upon human belief, human psychology, the attitude towards the world that most people have. And I mean, yeah, it's a terrible thing. You know, I actually need to turn it around because I got my phone right here and I keep looking at it and I keep getting distracted because things are popping up. And that is very telling, right? That our technology has, for the most part, particularly in the last century, as it has continued to develop and these communication technologies especially have become just very thoroughly saturating of our day-to-day existence, it has moved us away from thoughtfulness, let's say, for the most part. Television really accelerated that massively, and then the early adoptions of digital technology have extended a lot of what television brought into our lives. This constant distraction, this constant amusement, this constant entertainment, this evacuation of thinking, that people, it's so easy not to think when you're on your phone. I mean, I'm sure we've all had the experience, right? You're scrolling through social media, you're scrolling through one website, you're watching one video after another, and next thing you realize it's been 3 hours and you've done nothing. You've only made yourself feel worse about the world and worse about how you think, or what you think of things, I should say. And so I think this this unthinking technological adoption has greatly accelerated that nihilistic vision, because most of what you find through these media are things that are not actually edifying. They don't build up in any way your soul, your own thinking, your own attitudes. They mostly show you things that are negative and unhappy, and it's very easy to become down on the world when you exist in the digital. And you also get turned away from natural beauty, which I also find very striking. I went on a sort of nature hike a couple of weeks ago, and it was a group thing. It was at a like a nature preserve, and it was depressing to me to just see how many people were viewing things quite literally through their phone the whole time, taking pictures and just waiting for the picture. And, you know, putting it on Instagram or whatever. I thought, man, you guys are missing the point here. And I think one of the telling things as well, and we can move on after this, because I don't want to dwell on it too much. I dwell on it all the time. the bent neck, right? You know, there's an actual, you know, we talk about tech neck now, because people are always bent forward. It really physically shapes us away from what's proper to being human. Yeah. It's proper for us as human beings to be upright, to be able to look up. There are almost no other animals look up just for the sake of looking up. Hmm. If they look up, it's only to avoid a predator. But human beings have this ability to look at the sky and wonder, to look at the massiveness of the cosmos and truly take it in. And now, unfortunately, never really do that. You never see kids running around looking at the sky, looking at the clouds. No.
And if Aristotle's correct that philosophy begins in wonder, then our addiction to technology is going to be a real impediment to this kind of deep philosophical reflection. And in this book, which Introduction to Philosophical Principles, I don't know if you can see that. this book is Brian Kempel's book on philosophy. And I got to say, Brian, I've worked through this thing two times already, and I plan to do a third. It's quickly becoming one of my favorite textbooks on philosophy. But in here, you say that cosmological nihilism is actually the result of the cessation of philosophical inquiry. And if that's the case, then to the degree that we are saturating ourselves in the digital world, which is by nature reactionary and unreflective, to that same degree, are we going to suffer from a kind of philosophical shallowness, which will then breed cosmological nihilism, because it's, as you say, it's precisely the result of the cessation of philosophical inquiry. So I don't know if you have any final thoughts on that.
And I think, I was just having a very interesting conversation with someone yesterday about artificial intelligence, so-called. You always have to, it's hard. You want to use the terminology that everyone's familiar with, but also you have to quibble with the words that are chosen. But I was having a very interesting conversation with someone about it yesterday, in which we were just discussing the distinction between how technologies can stimulate us versus how technologies can substitute for us and step in for our own natural functions.
Yeah.
And I think that stepping in for our ability to ask questions, nobody really knows how to ask a good question anymore. It's one of the things I'm always, banging on about. But and part of that is our Googling habit, right? When we have a question, when something occurs to us that we don't know, we plug it into Google and there's the answer. And we think that's enough. We think we've actually asked the question, but we haven't. We haven't even dwelt on the question. We haven't allowed the question to develop or to become truly fruitful. And so the more we saturate ourselves with these technologies that substitute for our human faculties, the more we move ourselves away from that philosophical wonder, from that questioning, which is quintessentially human.
Yeah, we are definitely outsourcing so much of what we are to machines, our human intelligence. So let's shift gears a little bit. In his book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, Alex Rosenberg, who's a philosopher at Duke University, nicely sums up, I think, the intellectual vision that is cosmological nihilism with a series of questions and answers that he asks on page 3. Let me just read this for us, because I do think it's helpful. First question, is there a God? His answer, no. What is the nature of reality? What physics says it is? What is the purpose of the universe? There is none. What is the meaning of life? Ditto. Why am I here? Just dumb luck. Is there a soul? Is it immortal? Are you kidding? Is there free will? Not a chance. What happens when we die? Everything pretty much goes on as before, except us. And what is the difference between right and wrong, good and bad? Well, there is no moral difference between them. Now, Rosenberg is someone who gets almost everything wrong, but he has the virtue of being clearly wrong, and I think that makes him useful. But what's really curious about this book is the subtitle, because the subtitle is Enjoying Life Without Illusions. And Rosenberg, he wants to convince us that the truth of nihilism is no barrier to genuine human happiness. In fact, he's coined the phrase happy nihilism. I don't know if you've heard this phrase that comes from him. So Brian, what are your thoughts about the prospects of a happy nihilism? How is our society at large attempting to cope with the bleakness of the kind of cosmic insignificance that comes from this vision of life?
Yeah, it's what a curious phrase, right? Of course, when I hear people say things like this, my instinct is to say, well, what do you mean by happy? What exactly is this happiness that you're describing? Because it seems to me that it's more likely what someone with that attitude is actually pursuing is a kind of anesthesis, right? And let's just anesthetize the sufferings of life and call that happiness. Let's just find ways to numb our pain, to numb the struggle, to numb the fact that we have this innate inclination to desire the infinite, and we're unable to attain it on our own by enjoying the little things. Let's just we have our physical pleasures, we have them moderately so as not to cause ourselves more suffering or more pain. We have our little enjoyment. We find purpose in the little things that we do. We created this thing, we crafted this other, we built this beautiful thing that we enjoy looking at and that we get satisfaction out of doing, but then we die and it's okay. It doesn't sound very satisfying, I think.
No.
I believe it flees from the true deepest natural inclinations and yearnings of the human heart, which doesn't sound to me like happiness, but deception,
Yeah.
self-deception, self-delusion, and what an odd subtitle to have for his book when it sounds like no one could be more deluded, more committed to illusions than the
Right.
person who believes that happiness can be found in nihilism.
Yeah. In your article, you talk about how it's becoming increasingly fashionable in our culture today for people to turn to classical retrievals of Greek thought, such as Epicureanism and Stoicism, as a means of therapy to treat the specter of cosmic insignificance. So, analyze this trend for us, Brian. Can you explain why you think that these, I mean, you've kind of already spoken to it, but why are these therapeutic kind of remedies ultimately just, why do they fall short?
Yeah, so to credit where credit is due, this distinction and a lot of the thinking that I have on these questions is taken from a very good book by Elizabeth Lash Quinn, published in 2020 under the title Ars Vitae, something like the Fate of Inwardness. I can't remember the exact subtitle of it. Oh, it's a lengthy subtitle. But what Lash Quinn points out in that book is these various modern efforts at retrieving Gnosticism, Stoicism, Epicureanism, and I think there's one more that she has in the book. But these various approaches to life that were found in antiquity that were really quite radically different than the modern reappropriations of them, and the fundamental reason that they differ is that the modern reappropriations of them is as a form of modern therapy. It's a form of trying to accommodate oneself to the fact of this cosmic insignificance. That's the way that it's generally approached. So it's how do we use these ancient beliefs, which were instituted in a against a radically different background image,
Right.
to make us feel okay about the fact that we are cosmically insignificant somehow. And so this is also built on the work of Philip Reeve, who wrote a very interesting book in the mid-20th century under the title The Triumph of the Therapeutic, in which Reeve describes the way in which, the attitude of Western civilization in general has come to be sort of dominated by this nihilistic vision, this vision that's incapable of finding purpose in the world, and so strives to, sort of how do we adjust the self, right? How do we tweak the self to feel okay in the world somehow? And this is against the backdrop of psychology and psychotherapy becoming a kind of, priestly caste, almost as it were, in the 20th century, where the psychologist is going to be the one who has all the answers, who finally understands human nature and human behavior. And I don't think it's quite turned out that way. I think we've seen
No.
that that hasn't quite worked. But in general, this notion of therapy seems to be ordered towards, how do we feel okay?
Yeah.
Which is an interesting default position, which is to say that in some sense we don't feel okay. And rather than question why,
Yeah.
we're just trying to manage the symptoms, almost as it were. And I think what you see with a lot of these efforts at classical retrieval, or you see the same thing in the way that people will adopt, Zen Buddhism or something along those lines. They're really just trying to find a kind of lifelong palliative care.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Which I find kind of depressing personally.
Very depressing.
but I think that's what a lot of people are, they're not fully conscious of it, but
Yeah.
against this background image and saturated with the continual propounding of a cosmological nihilistic vision, what else do you do?
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of times it seems to me that in these retrievals, these popular retrievals, especially of Stoicism and Epicureanism, it's like the practical wisdom is abstracted away from the metaphysics. Like there's these positions have these, they're not just practical ways of living. They actually come with a robust understanding of the nature of reality. But at least in my experience, it seems like that part is left in ancient Greece, while they want to extract the practical wisdom from the metaphysics. I don't know if you see that same kind of pattern.
Yeah. And I mean, I've even seen this pattern applies to Aquinas with less success, let's say, because I think it's much harder to sort of grasp Aquinas's, let's say, moral doctrine apart from his metaphysics, because he's always talking about act and potency everywhere. Yeah. So not sure how you do that. But yeah, it's sort of it's cafeteria classicalism or something like that. I'm not sure how we would phrase it. But yeah, let's take their moral theory or their personal conduct theory, almost as it were, extract it from everything else, put it into the context of modern materialistic, reductionistic, physicalistic, et cetera, et cetera. And what you end up doing with that, I think, is continuing to exacerbate the presupposed dualism that a lot of people have as well.
Yeah.
So the psychological self, regarded as somehow fundamentally separate from the physical world, the psychological identity of the person as a radically autonomous construct or something like that. And that just becomes your adopted theory or practice for that psychological self, independent of the material physical world in which you live. Which, again, you're just finding new ways to be deluded about the nature of reality. Yeah, I am the executive editor of reality, so I could get to step in and say that that's not the right way to do it. That's
Well, let's shift and focus on that. Let's talk about what should be our response to the intellectual vision of cosmological nihilism. You say that what we really need in order to remedy the malaise of cosmic insignificance is not a therapeutic turn, but a genuine philosophical turn. You argue that what we need is to recover what you call our metaphysical sanity and our intellectual vision of cosmological order. And to do this, you say, we need to rediscover the thought of Thomas Aquinas. So flesh this out for us, Brian. How does Aquinas help to bring us back to a place of metaphysical sanity and restore to us a proper intellectual vision of cosmic order?
Yeah, this return to Aquinas. First of all, I'm always cautious with recommending Aquinas to people because he's an enormously difficult thinker. And I think it's an unfortunate tendency that some people think you can just pick him up and like, oh yeah, I understand exactly what he's saying. It takes years and years and years. And even then, I've been, I picked up Aquinas first when I was, I think, 14 or 15 years old. Didn't understand any of it, but found it fascinating. It's been, 20 plus years now that I've been reading Aquinas, and I'm starting to think I maybe understand him a little bit, right?
Same,
But
Brian, Richard Dawkins read him and immediately understood at a first pass.
Yeah. Well, I also like to point out to people that most people who first read Aquinas aren't actually reading Aquinas. They're reading a translation of Aquinas, and that's important,
yeah,
too.
Good point,
When we're reading a translation, we're reading an interpretation. Maybe I'll swing back to that in a bit. What I think one of the things we learn from a study of Aquinas, or even from people in the Thomistic tradition, is, again, to reiterate that pivotal, essential importance of questioning and really learning to question well. And a large part of that, and part of what's so difficult about that today, is that genuine questioning is always going to be discomforting in some way. It's going to throw you out of the comfort of how you live your life if you ask a genuine question about an important issue. You have to ask questions like, have I been going about my whole life in the wrong way? Do I believe things that are not true? Do I order my life by beliefs that are based on untruths? This is going to be uncomfortable. And you have to dwell in that discomfort to some extent in order to discover the answer. One of my other philosophical interests is the philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, American philosopher of the late 19th and early 20th century.
Also,
And he
not
has this.
An easy philosopher to read.
No. I even more strongly discourage people from trying to jump into Peirce than Aquinas. But one of the things that Peirce says that has always stuck with me very strongly since I first read it is he opposes doubt and belief as two distinct ways of having experience. And he describes doubt as the irritation of the mind that drives it to seek belief. That irritation. Most people today don't seem willing to suffer that kind of irritation, particularly not for any prolonged period of time. And so realizing that we have to experience that irritation, that we have to have those doubts in order to seek out beliefs that are true, that are properly accommodated to us as human beings, beliefs that are fitting for us as human beings, that satiate our human nature in some way. You have to go through the doubt, you have to go through the intellectual discomfort. And I think this is actually something that Aquinas is really quite excellent at. Anyone who has picked up the Summa Theologia knows that it has this format, right? This disputed question format, which was so central to the scholastic method of philosophical inquiry. And I think there's a tendency in the sort of modern cynical, skeptical view of things to look at the objections, the position against which Aquinas is responding, as merely a kind of foil, as merely something that he's setting up almost like a straw man in some sense to say, oh, you know, here's how I can show the truth by showing these things that are wrong. I don't think that's the case at all. I think
no,
he's really
not.
Addressing and entertaining and thinking through what those objections have
in
to
fact,
say.
In fact, when I read the Summa, sometimes I read the objections and I go, holy crap, how's he going to answer that? Like, that's a really mm-hmm. good objection. So he's definitely not setting up a straw man. I think Aquinas legitimately was trying to put the most pertinent and the strongest objections on the table.
Yeah, and when you look at his disputed question, you know, courses, essentially, these are courses taught at the University of Paris, like disputed questions on truth, on the power of God, on evil, right? These are amazing works. And there you actually see he takes that format to a much more intense degree, where in the Summa, he's usually going to have 2, 3, maybe 5 objections. In the disputed questions, he's going to have 12, 15,
16,
20. And
yeah.
He's going to have opposed positions too. And he's going to moderate between the two of
That's
them.
Right.
He's going to respond
That's right.
back and forth.
And sometimes you can't determine whether the opposed position is something that he actually endorses or just another bad view. I'm actually working through, just again, to plug the Lyceum again. One great way to learn Aquinas is to do it through the Lyceum Institute. I'm working through, I can't remember what you title the course, but it's the one on the De Veritate part one. And I've been working through that. So I've been reading De Veritate, which I've read before, but I have to say having those lectures it just helps so much to understand. But this is exactly what I'm encountering. The De Veritate, I mean, it's an avalanche of objections. I think some of the questions that I read even this morning or yesterday morning, it's like 16 objections before he even starts to give the answers. So,
yeah, and it's difficult. And I think as a modern reader who's used to the format of, you know, like here's just my lengthy argument, here's my essay form of argumentation, it can be kind of painful to accommodate
yeah.
ourselves to that questioning. But it's, I think, one of the things that we most need to do in order to recover our own philosophical habituation to the point where we can really ask questions again and really think, you know, are we doing things the right way instead of just jumping into a belief system or something like that, as so many people seem very, very willing to do today. And moreover, I also think that in addition to his methodology, which is... I would say is very much an incredibly orderly approach to these issues and these questions. To even come back to this point about metaphysical sanity, Aquinas's vision Again, his image may have been incorrect factually in terms of the constitution of the universe, but his vision and his habits of vision applied to the facts that have been revealed since his time show again the orderliness of things. When we stop and really start to question, well, okay, you know, why are there galaxies? Why is there, you know, this enormous expanse of things? Maybe we don't have answers to those particular questions, but that doesn't take away from the fact that it's actually a wonderful order in the universe, that there are these interactions of act and potency, there are natures. And my favorite sort of cosmologically explanatory text from Thomas Aquinas is in the Summa Theologia, in the Prima Pars, in question 45, article 7. He has this beautiful text there on whether there is in all creation a vestige of the Trinity. So taking Trinitarian theology and applying it metaphysically to the whole order of creation, it's just this wonderful text, incredibly illuminating. I've read it so many times. I'm probably starting to wear that page out on my copy of the Summa, you know, turning back and forth and underlining things. I've marred all of my beautiful books with marginalia and underlining.
Those are such nice books. Yeah, those are such nice books, that edition of Aquinas. I have the same one. It's like sometimes it feels wrong to write in them because they're so nice.
Yeah, but sometimes you just you need to engage with the text as best you can, right? So
mine are all highlighted up.
Yeah, it's I demurred for a long time before I decided to write in them, but I just couldn't. I was starting to fill up too many notebooks and loose pieces of paper and things. It made sense, but this notion of the threefold order of all things. When you grasp what Aquinas is saying there, it's impossible to not see it everywhere. And seeing it everywhere, you see this return of an image of the cosmos, which despite its enormity, is nevertheless profoundly ordered. And we see that human beings play a distinct role in that order, that we're not just these accidents that have emerged through some sort of evolutionary concatenation of chance events, but that there's intelligibility to the fact of our existence.
Yeah, and that the universe is infused with meaning. Like there's meaning in things. And I think that most people in our culture are habituated, when it comes to meaning, I think they're habituated to think of meaning as strictly something that's mental or in an interior phenomenon, right? Meaning is in the head. It's a person relative. It's something that we impose on nature. So when we hear like Aquinas talk about the physical universe being permeated with meaning, I think it's hard for a modern person to even comprehend what this means. So Brian, could you talk to us about meaning? What does it mean to say that natural things are meaningful? What does it mean to say that the universe is meaningful?
See, this is where things get dangerous, Anthony, because we scheduled this talk for an hour, and now we're broaching a topic that I'll rant about for four or five. So I'll try to be as succinct as possible. Well, we use the word meaning in contemporary 21st century English. We typically intend one of three different things by it. And I think the confusion of these three different senses, the conflation of them, leads into more confusion than is necessary, unfortunately. There's always some degree of confusion in our lives which is necessary, but sometimes it's too much. And so I think for a lot of people, when they hear the term meaning or they talk about things as meaningful, their inclination is to interpret this as personal attachment to something. If I think about it, something as meaningful, it's okay because it has a sentimental value to me, or it's somehow important in how I conduct my life, which is, again, already in an interesting way to conceive of these things in a therapeutic context. And we're thinking about things in terms of how they make us feel and how they make us feel better, especially. But what's often missing from that is another sense of the term that we still use, that's widely used. People ask you things like, what do you mean by that? Right? What are you trying to signify? In other words, is what they're asking. What is the intelligibility that can be shared between us in whatever this thing is that we're talking about? And what's become lost in our world is that there's a really intimate connection between those two things. You can't actually have any sort of sentimental attachments to something, any sort of personal importance placed upon something, unless you have a grasp of what it is in the first place. Part of the problem, part of what has resulted in the divorce of these two things, is a general skepticism about the human ability to truly know things, to grasp that meaning in the first place, to be able to answer the question, what is that thing? What is it in itself? And again, that fundamental importance of questioning is necessary to retrieve if we want to be able to answer the questions, what is that thing? What are those things? What really are they in themselves? Upon which we can base whether or not they're actually or should be important to us or not. Which isn't to say that, you know, something that's unimportant in itself can't become important for us. You think about small gestures of gifts and things that people give to you. They're important because of the what of the gesture, right? The what of the sign of, say, you know, love. If a spouse gives someone a little stupid present, right? The thing itself might not be very important. It might be a cheap gift given, you know, when you're poor or something like that growing up, you know, teenagers or young adults. But it has this great importance because of what it signifies, not just because of how it makes you feel. It's the fact that someone did this, that they made this gesture, that they invested the time or the energy or the effort or whatever it may have been to produce this thing for you, to give this thing to you, that makes it meaningful, not just, again, the emotional satiation that you happen to derive from it.
Yeah. So when we say, let me know what you think about this. When we say that things have meaning, what we mean is that things in the cognition independent or extramental world have their own being. They have their own intelligible structure, right? And they have their own goodness, a goodness that is in themselves, according to what they are, entirely apart from their utility, right? Entirely apart from the goodness that perceptual objects might have for us. There's an intelligibility and a goodness in things themselves. I mean, is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, and this is actually, I was flipping through Aquinas' Summa Contra Gentiles this morning, and he says this in book two, I think it's chapter 27, 26, somewhere around there, that he makes it very clear there that a thing's goodness to us is only proportioned to our understanding of it. Unless we can actually grasp what the thing is in some way, we cannot perceive or evaluate accurately in any sense whatsoever what's good about it. We might have a sense that it's good, right, from some sort of vague cognition, but you have to have that cognition of the thing to see why it is good.
Yeah,
it can't just be this internal sort of, oh, I'm making these evaluations entirely independent of a knowledge of the thing. You have to have the knowledge. And so unless, again, we can recover good habits of learning, good habits of actually coming to study things as they are, to inquire into them as they are, we can't actually order ourselves towards the good.
Yeah. So in the act of intellectual discovery, what we're discovering is the what of things, right? This is the first act of the mind, simple apprehension, where we encounter intelligible meaning as it exists in the world, of which the intellect, of course, forms a concept. But what we're discovering in this intellectual act are things that have whatness to them, right? Substances with natures, with essential properties, with proportionate ends, things that have a certain kind of existence. And this is kind of what we mean, right, by deep metaphysical meaning of reality, is that there's an intelligibility built into the structure of nature itself.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's a bit of a question, a little probably too into the weeds, but what's really fascinating as well when we get after the natures of things, when we start to inquire into them, is we also, the things of the world, the things of the finite created universe in which we all find ourselves, is that each of them is intelligible not only in itself, but also in a very complex web of relations. And that seeing these things
in their
relativity informs us a great deal about not only those things, but about the whole of the cosmos again. Right? That there is this innate relativity of each thing, that everything is dependent in some way on other things that we encounter. That leads us towards, you know, other questions about, okay, well, where does that dependence come from? How's that dependence satiated? Yeah. How is that dependence answered?
And that's what we mean by cosmological order, is the interrelatedness of these intelligible things.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have a certain sympathy for a lot of the confusion which stems out of the scientific revolution, let me put it this way. That all of a sudden there's been this long-standing presupposed order about the nature of the cosmos, and then we discover that things aren't really working the way that we thought they were, and that it does seem like there's a lot more randomness and chance which is operative in the universe than you have under the conception of a sort of Ptolemaic vision of the mm-hmm. universe, you know, the celestial spheres orbiting the Earth, or I don't know if you'd call it revolving around the Earth or something like that. So there's this sense of chaos, which I think comes to the fore. And then you have theories of evolution in the 19th century, most prominently Darwin's. And I can have a sympathy for that sort of doubt which comes in consequence of that. But I think a lot of people went for the easier answer to that doubt, which is to say there is no meaning. Intellectually, that's easier to just abandon the deeper yearnings of our heart, which are oftentimes quite painful to us, quite discomforting. And people stopped trying to really discover where that governing order is and just say there is none, which also has moral consequences, because then you can just justify doing whatever you want, which is a powerful anesthetic in its own right. But yes, this coming back to the question of order and the discovery of order, when you really look into things, when you look into the fact of what has emerged in the universe through whatever theory is put forward, I mean, whether it's a sort of Big Bang cosmological evolution or a more fundamentalist creationism, there's very clearly order in things. Even if at times the picture that we get looks like a disordered one, it's really hard to deny the order when you look at how things emerge and develop and change and come into being.
Well, even at a more primordial level, you know, when you think about the very nature of disorder, how could we even recognize disorder, right? How could we even recognize chance unless it was built upon a fundamentally deeper order of things, right? Not only ontologically, like, obviously, for us to be here and to talk about chance events and so forth, ontologically, there has to be a deep order to the nature of reality for that to be able to take place. There has to be this system of final causality, which is, of course, the cause of causes. If you don't have final causality, if things aren't inherently pointed to certain ends, then you don't have efficient causality. So I think that the scientific revolution, at kind of a superficial level, lends itself toward cosmological nihilism. But again, the more you reflect on the nature of order itself, on the nature of causality itself, you realize that there has to be fundamental order at the very bottom, right? Mm-hmm. Like I said, even to recognize and understand, to make intelligible the notion of chance, we have to have first fundamentally the notion of order.
Yeah, actually, that brings to mind another quote of Charles Peirce, which is that efficient causality without final causality is worse than useless.
just randomness.
It doesn't actually explain anything, right?
Chaos.
You've given up the idea of causality if you jettison final causality from your schema of it. And so, from the most minuscule things that we can observe to the greatest structures of the universe, order is necessarily present in our, even just our ability to understand it.
That's right.
If you think about, the formation of a water molecule, why does that bond actually occur? Like, what is a drive? Why would it occur in just this way? Why is there a necessity which obtains in the interactions between the hydrogen and the oxygen through some sort of infusion of energy? Like, well, why does this happen? Well, there has to be some
The electron in my pocket right now, why does it have a certain kind of nature and a certain kind of causal propensity that's identically the same as an electron in the Andromeda galaxy, right? Once you start to think deeply about this, like you said, it's a matter of like cleansing your intellectual vision of the cosmos. Because if you can reflect philosophically at a sufficiently deep level, you realize that the universe is in fact suffused with order at its foundation, at the foundational level. Because we couldn't have any act of the intellect. We couldn't have science. There couldn't be beings. Things that have substances that have characteristic powers and activities. You couldn't have that unless you had primordial order to the universe, and that gets missed.
And I think again, the constitution of the image, the background image of the cosmos that most people have. You hear about all this sort of emptiness and the disorder and the chaos, and you get, these science documentaries where they show you boiling stars and all these sorts of things. And it looks very chaotic and it looks very destructive. And it gives you this sort of false snapshot, I think, where you see, in effect, what is a swirling chaos of potency, of things undergoing change. But what's missed in that image is that potency is always fundamentally directed towards act.
That's right.
Chance and change are always for the sake of order, and some order to come into an emergent reality in some way. So the formation of a galaxy might be this, sort of swirling event of chaos, and yet it is a formation. Something coming into a holding, persisting, enduring form. Maybe not enduring forever, but one that is, not only is it enduring and existing, it's something which is manifested to us.
Yes. Yeah, there's something
there to
incredible,
be discovered.
Right, and there's something incredible about the human being, right? I mean, even if you accept the idea that the universe is just a chaotic soup, let's say, there's still something wondrous to it, because I can think about it in here. Like, I'm a kind of being, super finite, so imperfect in so many ways, and yet I can entertain the notion, the idea of the entirety of the universe. Like, what is that? So you're in this weird kind of schizophrenic, a lot of modern people, because I think it's a common modern notion to look out there and see chaos. But in here, everybody recognizes order, right? And intelligibility. And unless you have a metaphysical foundation, that's kind of a schizophrenic worldview, right?
Well, and
it doesn't match up. It doesn't make sense.
And it's quite backwards, right? We're all actually probably a lot less ordered up here than we'd like to think that we are. And whatever order we do have up there, whatever order we have in our minds, is entirely dependent upon the order of things that we've experienced independently of ourselves.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. There would be no order that we could have in our minds if it weren't for the fact that it is impressed on us quite literally at the level of basic sensation. Entirely prior to our minds. Just even the functioning of sense has to be something which is incredibly ordered, orderly for us to have any experience whatsoever. The constitution of our faculties, our organs of the environment around us, all has to be orderly in order for us to think anything at all.
That's
we're incredibly dependent incredibly dependent
even
on
the theory of evolution
universe.
Which even the theory of evolution, which is dependent in some way on random mutation, right? So people often say at the heart of evolution is randomness. No, that's not true, because randomness is worthless unless you already have substances with certain kinds of natures that exist and can be changed in certain kinds of ways. So you need actualities in order to actualize potencies, right? So you have this fundamental relation between act and potency, even undergirding the entire story of evolution itself. So yeah, there's so many ways in which order is foundational, and the more you think about it, the more you see it.
Yeah, there's a great quote I heard from a professor in grad school, John Hittinger. I think he attributed it to Father William Wallace, not the great Scotsman, but the Dominican father and scientist and philosopher.
The Modeling of Nature, right? Is that his book?
Yeah, it's actually sitting right back here on my shelf, on my desk. But the quote was that chance rides piggyback on nature.
That's a great quote.
You can't have chance without nature, right? Chance of what?
That's
chance
right.
For what?
Aristotle showed us between. That a long time ago.
Yeah, the intersection of two usually dissociated lines of causality is all we mean by chance.
That's right.
So you have to have the causality there in the first place in order for the chance to occur.
Chance is accidental on order.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's so much we could talk about here, Brian. I wanted to get into a discussion about causality and how the modern notion of causality has kind of fueled this cosmological nihilism, and how a return to the more Aristotelian classical view of causality helps to purify our intellectual vision. But let me just, in your essay, you make a statement that I just have to put out there and give you a chance to expand, related to this question of cosmic order. You write that the meaning of anything entails a meaning of everything, and the meaning of everything suggests a divine source for the cosmos. So can you kind of unpack this for us?
Yeah, we've already, in some way, thankfully, I think, because again, that's a point that could go on for quite some time in exposition. We've already covered in some sense the reason why, right? That when we discern the meaning, again, the nature, the intelligibility of anything, which is the ground of any possible meaning that could be attributed to any of our experience, we discover this innate relativity. There's a very felicitous but difficult expression which Aquinas uses, actually building off of Boethius, which is, he talks about the relativum secundum dici and the relativum secundum esse. And I won't go off on the hour-long tangent that that is. But anything that we talk about, in order to talk about it meaningfully and intelligibly, requires that we bring it into the context of its relativity to other things. You know, if you think about the most fundamental relationships that you have with other people in your life, mothers, fathers, spouses, children, all of those are relative terms. You're describing not something as it is in itself, but something as it is revealed to you in relation, that it is made known to you in relation. And so the meaning of that thing is tied into the meaning of other things. You talk about a man as a father, you're talking about a man as tied into something else. You're talking about the great chain of being in some way, whether you realize it or not, that each of these things is in some existence as relative to others. And so thinking about the meaning of that one thing immediately ties you into thinking about the meaning of other things.
Yeah.
You are brought into an potentially ad infinitum series of questions by questioning the meaning of anything. But ultimately what that shows is that everything is meaningful in some way. And just as the meaning of each thing is dependent upon other things that are finite in their own meaning, all of that orders us to thinking, wait, where does this meaning ultimately come from?
Yes, very good.
What is the ultimate cause for the fact that any one thing has meaning at all? Well, it has to be something that can't be reduced to any of them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Brian, there's so much still that I'd like to talk about, so we'll have to have you back. Maybe we can have you back, talk about causality. Of course, there's this question lingering over this conversation that we're having, and that is, what do we do about evil? you know, how does suffering fit into the cosmic order? That's a big question. So maybe we'll dedicate a future episode to just that question. But with the couple minutes we have left, let's conclude with some practical wisdom for the listeners. How do we build the habits of a metaphysically sane cosmological vision in the midst of a nihilistic society, in the midst of this constant pressure that's exerted from our culture that attunes us and molds our perceptual habits? So what practical advice can you give to those who want to become, to use a term that you coin in your book, teleologically observant?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing, and exhort everyone to this who has interest in the intellectual life to any extent whatsoever, whether you're, you know, seeking graduate degrees or you're just trying to sort of, you know, answer those questions of the human heart that we all have in some sense. The first principle to any sort of intellectual endeavor is humility. None of us has the answers. Truth is not a possession. Truth is something in which we participate, and you can participate in it only by being humble and by realizing that it's not something that you possess, that it's not something you own, it's not something that's yours. You don't have the truth. I don't have the truth. No human being has the truth. It's something that we order ourselves towards. And ordering ourselves towards it, I think actually helps to continually renew that sense of wonder, which is the birth of philosophical inquiry, philosophical speculation, and indeed being teleologically observant, seeing that there is, in fact, order and purpose, and it's not something that I can impose on the world.
Yeah.
It's actually something that I have to subordinate myself towards, which is humbling, and oftentimes results in a certain degree of a bit of humiliation. But there's no humility without humiliation, so that's that's well and fine, right? We all have to accept that we don't know things that we think we do, and that we have to continue to question. And I think just, you know, trying to adopt that attitude regularly. I know I fail at it all the time. I can be arrogant and haughty and dismissive and tell people that they're stupid. If you follow my Twitter account, you'll unfortunately see that way too often. just trying to cultivate that attitude in the everyday of, no, I'm seeking the truth. I don't possess it. I think that actually helps to...
Go ahead. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
I was going to say, I think that helps to sort of help us withdraw from that cosmological nihilism, to step back. Because the more you think you know things, the more you're going to think that, you know, no, there is no meaning out there, right? There is no, I already have the answers. I don't need to seek them. It's very contracting. That contracts the human soul rather than expands it.
Yeah. And it's so contrary to the philosophical spirit as it was conceived, you know, not the philosophical spirit that we see in contemporary academic philosophy, but as it was conceived, philosophy is the love of wisdom. And as Aquinas tells us, this word philosophy goes all the way back to Pythagoras. People were trying to call Pythagoras a sophist, a wise man, Thomas tells us. But Pythagoras said, no, he didn't want to be called a wise man because he felt like he wasn't wise. Rather, he wanted to be called a lover of wisdom or a pursuer of wisdom. And I think that is truly the philosophical spirit. When done well, philosophy should be motivated by humility, by this desire to not just know the true and love the good, but to conform yourself to the true and to the good. Right? And that's another act of humility. So this has all been great. Here's some practical advice for anyone listening. If you want to sharpen your intellectual vision of cosmological order, well, there's this thing called the Lyceum Institute that you can go online right now to Lyceum Institute, lyceum.institute, and you can join a community that is doing just this. And that's really what's happening there, Brian. I can say from my own testimony is that it is iron sharpening iron, and it's great to be part of a community where we're all trying to purify this vision that we have of reality and pursuing. What's being displayed for me there is truly the philosophic spirit, people questing for the truth. So, Brian, thanks for joining me today. It's been a real joy.
Yeah, it's absolutely my pleasure, Anthony. I look forward to doing it again, hopefully sooner rather than later.